Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Barlingham Barrett. My name is Simon Barrett, and I'm joined by my very good friend, veteran trial lawyer Manny Barling. Manny, good afternoon.
Afternoon, Simon, and welcome everybody who can't stand the NBC's coverage of the Olympics. If you want to know a score, you get it 3 hours before you get the result at NBC.
Oh, don't get me started. I'll rant for the next 90 minutes on this.
But as we agreed, next week, for our listeners, we're going to get into NBC, the media, and how they're affecting this election. And I know John Perry is sitting there going, oh, I can't wait to do that because that's a favorite topic of John's. But we're going to hit another favorite topic of John's. And we're gonna, let me introduce some guests. We have John Perry on the phone, who's been a guest before with us. But for those of you who haven't heard John, John's a distinguished graduate of McKenna College, where and he's going to use his degree in economics to attack me today with a cleaver. He's also the owner of Sunset Protective Services and Investigations, the top security and investigative company in Los Angeles. But don't take John's views too seriously, okay? Because personally, he can change them any time, and he will change them any time if it suits the audience. In fact, he'll change his opinions more often than Mitt Romney at a country barbecue. John, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Manny, as I like to call myself the conscience of the show.
That's only if we're eating the wrong kryptonite like Superman did. And from the Midwest, we have Sam Moffey. We welcome Sam, who brings some Midwestern common sense to all of our arguments, and he keeps us grounded. Sam's a noted author and bar owner in Poland, and that's Poland, Ohio, of course. Sam, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, but pleasure to be back.
By the way, Poland, Ohio is not where Mitt Romney's going on Tuesday. That's the other Poland.
You know why? Because someone told him that Sarah Palin can't see Russia from there. Go ahead, Sam.
I was just going to say, he loves England.
Yeah, he does. There's new people to piss off in England that he hasn't pissed off here. And our last guest and panel member is Peter T. Haven. To keep everyone on the straight and narrow, we bring you Peter because he's a lawyer's lawyer. Peter is our go-to guy when we all need to be grounded in the law and common sense. Welcome, Peter, and thank you for bringing some common sense to a show full of raging, ranting lunatics.
Well, I thank you very much, and I'm gonna let everybody play today. I'm not going to officiate too hard.
Oh, good. We hope you jump in with both feet, which makes you qualify as either an NFL or a baseball umpire, referee or umpire, because lately when I'm watching baseball, it seems like the umpires are jumping in and taking too much control of the game again. But we'll get into that in another show, won't we?
Right. Hey, Sam, before we get started, I'm waiting for Romney to make the huge gaffe while he's in Israel. Hey, I can see Palestine from my bedroom window.
Oh, I'm waiting for him to stand up and say some of my best friends are Jews. That sounds like a Mormon.
You guys don't realize something, though. You know, the Mormons have a huge campus in Jerusalem. I think it's in Jerusalem. And have a big presence in Israel because my wife lived in a kibbutz for 18 years. Yeah. And was amazed at the Mormons who would come when no one else was coming to Israel with all the wars and the rockets and whatnot, the Mormons would constantly show up there and pilgrimage to Israel, especially the kibbutz she was at, En Gev, which is right on the edge of the Dead Sea. And they would then, the funny thing is they did at the kibbutz is that they served fish there and they called it St. Peter's Fish. Mm-hmm. And that was a big money maker for the kibbutz, was all the Mormons coming over doing the pilgrimage and spending lots of money at the tourist trap.
Yeah, so, they were probably just looking for new wives.
Well, maybe they were hoping to get some new underwear while they were there. But Sam, you know, one of the reasons is fundamentalist Christians across the United States, regardless of whether they're Mormons or more traditional, support Israel a great deal for one simple reason. They know if the Muslims take control of Israel, they will deny them access to the Holy Land and destroy traditional Christian monuments. And as a result, the Christian movement has actually become a stronger supporter of Israel than any other single group. And I applaud them for it because it's important to their religion, important to my religion. I was born and raised a Catholic, and important to the world that we preserve those artifacts so we don't have the problems they've had where the Muslims, fundamentalist Muslims in Afghanistan, destroyed all of those relics that have been carved 3,000 years ago into a mountain.
Well, that's very well put, Manny. The evangelicals are very big supporters, and I don't think a lot of Americans know that.
I think only the ones who are evangelicals know. But, and again, I salute them and compliment them for it. It's a worthy cause, and they've really stood up during difficult times and done a terrific job. But oddly enough, our show today is about something entirely different, and I'm going to do a couple-minute rant to give our audience where we're going and sort of set the stage. Today's show is about the poor. It's about riots, joblessness, and how they affect our country overall, and of course the upcoming election. We're going to briefly discuss the recent riots in Anaheim, California, as the so-called home of the Happy Kingdom of Walt Disney, as a base to jump off into the general topic of rioting and future riots in general in the U.S. And we're going to jump into a little history to make a comparison to the poor, joblessness, and the revolution among labor that led up to World War I, namely that robber baron period from the 1880s to 1900. There's many similarities that hopefully will cause our listeners to look at the bigger picture of what's going on in America. And before we jump into that, let's jump into a little bit about Anaheim, and then I'm going to come back to my little bit of rant about history. You know, I'm going to quote Clement Price, a Rutgers University historian, where he says, "Riots don't just happen." And this is contrast to the comments of Jose Moreno, who's a California State University Long Beach professor, who also sits on the Anaheim School Board and is president of Los Amigos Orange County group. It's a community organization of Latinos. And this was his comment about what's going on in Anaheim. "What we have here is concentrated power in the hands of a wealthy minority, a working class and working poor Latino majority that feels it has no voice, coupled with completely uneven distribution of the city's resources, and then suddenly the deaths of two Latino men in the span of 1 week." To understand Anaheim, and certainly Peter, John, and I do, living in this side of the country, it's a city that sprawls over about 50 square miles. It includes Anaheim Stadium and the Los Angeles Angels and the Anaheim Ducks, in terms of a hockey team. Latinos hold many of the area's low-wage hospitality jobs. Most live in the poor and working-class neighborhoods near the center and northern sections of the town, known as the Flatlands. For Latinos in Anaheim, the median income is $49,000 a year. Nearly 20% of the city's Hispanic population lived in poverty. About 13% is the national average. So just across the Riverside Freeway, many of the city's affluent, mostly white families live in the northwestern stretch known as the Hills. Not surprisingly, four of the city's council five members live in the Hills. So for those who don't know what happened, basically what we had in Anaheim was a series of shootings. It started out, one was a wedding where supposedly gang members jumped in, and then one of them got shot, and then when things started to simmer down the next day, the police shot and killed another Latino man, but they said it was a gang member who shot at officers while fleeing. None of us know the true facts of either of these, although some of the films have been shown on TV. And then Friday, the police were involved in a third shooting in less than a week when they opened fire on two men fleeing a burglar alarm. One escaped, the other was bitten by a police dog and arrested. So these killings have sparked days of intermittent clashes between protesters and the police. Looters entered some stores, they broke windows, while some demonstrators marched through the town armed with nothing but signs. Others set fires. It took riot gear and clashes with the crowd, and at least two dozen were arrested, and there were a number of people injured. So right now I'm going to go to John. And John, why don't you give everybody a brief summary of what it's like to be a police officer and face these type of situations, having no political belief at the time and only dealing with the situation. What's it like for an officer to be involved in that?
Well, I could tell you from the Rodney King riots, I think it was 92.
Actually, it was April of 92.
20 years ago already. I remember being extremely frustrated because I saw this lawlessness and disorder and people preying upon one another and businesses, and most of the deputies wanted to take proactive measures, and because of the politics, we were prevented from doing so, and a lot of this city burned down. And who suffers? The very people who supposedly these protesters are supposed to be marching for and supporting. It never affects the rich communities, Manny. They always burn their own neighborhoods.
Right. Well, that's usually because their own neighborhoods are owned by the rich communities.
There's a lot of small businesses down there, too.
Well, that's true, but in terms of owning the land and the building, they are traditionally owned by large, a lot, you know. Well,
they won't go in there, Manny. There's no grocery stores banks or things like that down in those areas because they know they're going to be targets.
Oh, absolutely.
People buy their groceries at the liquor store.
And that is one of the biggest problems in that community. So, Sam, have you seen any riots in Cleveland? I don't remember any recent ones.
Any say again, Manny?
Is there any a history of any riots in the last 25 years in Cleveland at all?
Well, the biggest riots where they were at 68 was the Huff riots, they called them. They were to Cleveland what the Rodney King riots were to L.A., put down by the National Guard. It was pretty bad. And that area, what happened is it was a lot of the Jewish population. Cleveland has a very sizable Jewish population. And there was a lot of the Jewish people they owned the stores in the community, but they didn't live there anymore. And the blacks had moved in over the years, and they just destroyed every store they didn't own. And, you know, no one ever repeats them. And over the last 30 years with urban renewal and all that stuff from the 1960s to the turn of the century, it was funny that instead of blacks opening up stores there or things of that nature, these are non-profit development corporations that do nothing but to promote themselves, and that would employ some of the blacks and were kind of in bed with the local politicians, the councilmen, and whatnot, or it was Arabs owning the stores. And that's
so
what came
words,
in
them. They perpetuated the poverty is what they did, right?
Right, yeah, they did that. And in Youngstown, there was there's never been major riots per se around here, but there's just a lot of violence. There's a, you know, when you were describing about Anaheim, Youngstown itself is, I think, proportionally there's like 70,000 people in the city, and I think that's high. But we have a murder rate that would be worse than New York City's or Chicago's, but proportionally.
Yeah, in fact,
my
wife points out that when she was young, the population of Youngstown was around 150,000. And through all of this, it declined down to the number you're describing and the town. And of course, my father-in-law reminded me that this was caused in part by them building the channel through Pittsburgh for the for things to be hauled down through the Ohio River and bypassed basically Youngstown, which left them in a lurch in terms of growth, and the city never grew anymore.
I'd have to argue that would happen. We still had a huge steel population here, and the steel barons and the union became pigs, and they destroyed them. They killed the goose that was laying the golden egg, the steel industry. My stepfather, who was a head of human resources at the which caused Youngstown Sheet and Tube, lost his job along with 30,000 other people. We call it Black Monday around here in September. We were out of business. I mean, there was like 100, and that was in 1978. That's been the guillotine to the economy around here, and it's just starting to come back only because of the huge discovery of Marcellus shale oil boom in our area and in western Pennsylvania, and it's bringing in jobs by the bushels.
Well, that's good to hear. I was horrified to see the state of your area when I traveled back there. And in my years of marriage, I saw the decline sharply even during that limited period of time. And it was really very disturbing. But that's what we're dealing with.
When I got married, and my my in-laws are from Holland, and I took them for it. And you know how valuable land is because it's so small, and they can only build up and they can't anymore. Well, I just drove them through a part of Youngstown that had just been, I mean, it literally holds this whole street around here with nothing on it by a fire flood. Houses have been destroyed, devastated. I mean, it looks like Eastern Europe after World War II. It's terrible. And
yeah,
no one's doing anything with it.
Well, Peter, I want to bring you in. I know you're just a young pup. You're younger than us old folks. Are you old enough to remember the Rodney King riots?
I remember them. I thank you for that. There's no doubt I was old enough. I was in law school at the time, and I remember it very well.
Peter, how much did you pay him to say that?
I don't know. I think he's just trying to be nice today. I have no idea.
Well, let me tell you my Rodney King story. I was in trial in L.A. Superior Court, Peter, when the riot started, and this note came in, and, you know, in the middle of trial when clerks deliver notes to the judge, you normally go, oh, God, what is his wife's calling or something? Yet we could see the face on the judge, and we could see whatever it was he was deeply upset about. And he turns to us and he says, I don't want anybody to be alarmed, but we seem to have a riot starting right now in somewhere in South Los Angeles, and we've been asked to evacuate the building. So you only have a few minutes, and you need to go. And you know, but I doddered around. You know, you kind of take a little while to get your stuff together in trial, and you're kind of loping out the door. And the first thing I noticed coming out of the street entrance, you know, the Grand Avenue, or excuse me, the First Street entrance going to where the parking lot's there, was full of billowing smoke from South L.A. And I actually worked, when I was at USC, I actually worked in South Los Angeles during the time of the Watts riots, and I understood why they had happened. And I looked at that, and I thought it was, oh, here we go. It's the Watts riots all over again. And, you know, for about the next couple of years, I drove around with a gun in my car because I didn't feel particularly comfortable down there. And that, such was the way of the riots for Rodney King. And, you know, John, I disagree with you about some of the things. One of the things that upset me most about the Watts riots is our dear police chief, and I'll be kind to him and not mention him by name today, I thought reenacted what he did during the Watts riots in the terms of hands off, because he was in charge of the Newton Division at the time, at 77th Precinct, actually, at the time of the Watts riots. And he was in West L.A. by my house at some event, and I think his attitude was, you know, they've opposed me, they've done this or that, screw them, let them burn. And I really felt that he had this apathetic, terrible attitude about South Los Angeles throughout his entire time as a police chief that I thought really contributed greatly to our problems in the city. You might have a more benign viewpoint of him, but as
realistic.
Did you have much respect for him?
You're talking about Daryl Gates.
Yes, I was going to leave him nameless, but yes.
Well, I never worked under him, but I can tell you his troops had a deep respect and admiration for him, and that's good enough for me. And I don't know why he kind of dropped the ball during that period. He definitely did, you're right. But I don't think it was for the malignant reasons you're articulating.
You're being nice to him.
Manny, he was very popular among the troops.
Well, I know, but being popular among the troops doesn't necessarily make you a good police chief. It just makes you handle your troops well and have them like you. And I'm sure if police chief allows his troops to beat the shit out of anyone they like, he's going to be popular.
They were motivated to do a good job, and that's an important aspect of being a leader.
Well, I agree with you completely. I have never thought very much of him as a police chief, and I thought he caused more problems than they help. And by the way, I only harp on this for a moment, because when we come back to this discussion, that's one of the problems.
One more thing, Manny. William Parker said he was the best driver he ever had.
You know, he did say that. He did say that.
Go ahead.
So coming back to the bigger issue on this is, what we have is an issue that police chiefs often contribute to the problem because they're corrupted by the political nature of the city. So here you've got a police chief in Anaheim who so far has seemed to have acted very reasonably, who's stuck trying to appease the minority who control the majority of the government and the money, and at the same time balance that by trying to satisfy the needs of the individual. But let's go to what our problem is. The problem is there's not enough jobs. We have unemployment increasing. The poor are the ones who experience this the most. And what we have is riots that arise out of them. I went back to the 1890s during what I like to refer to as the Robert Barron period, where I've said a number of times on the show, and John and I have discussed this for years over lunch, is the effect that the Robert Barons had on labor and what eventually started a revolution around the world. And for those people who think that we don't have a problem right now around the world, I looked at a morning news comment about China. Right now, China shut down building a wastewater pipeline in Qidong because basically it was such a huge protest about, corruption, people getting rich and getting their, you know, money out of it, a paper-making company that was polluting and causing people to die from dire environmental damage over a three-decade period. And so I think there were several thousand of them basically stormed it. And the best part to me is they caught one of the leaders of the local party, and they all saw he was wearing an Italian silk shirt, which offended them all, and they ripped his shirt off in a symbolic gesture because he was living too well. So, you know, basically earlier this month in China, they had a copper plant in Sichuan province that was halted after thousands clashed with police. And I would describe China right now as 1890 to the early 1910 Russia, where it was in constant revolution over labor issues and a drive for equality, increased money, and the rich got richer, which has been evidenced by Bo's decline in China and the indictment of his wife for murdering an American businessman, or maybe it was British, and all these other events going on. So they're struggling through the issues of the Industrial Revolution, where we should not be. But by taking away the antitrust laws under Ronald Reagan, and in a way I think Ronald Reagan would be turning over in his grave because he saw American business as more benign and helping the general people in America and fostering growth. And I think if he saw the greed that had changed in American corporations between the 1930s and this particular period, he might not have been as keen as towards removing the antitrust rules. So let's talk a little bit about the poor, how this has affected people in Anaheim, and how Anaheim, like a lot of smaller cities, and including your description of Youngstown, Sam, reflects a microcosm of the growing unrest in the United States that may lead to the same kind of riots we had in the 1890s and in the 1960s. Peter, historically, you want to jump into that first? Do you have any comments?
About Anaheim?
No, about this reoccurring theme in history when the poor get poor and there's no jobs in sight and there's poverty,
yeah.
Whether it's the French Revolution, the 1890s or now, it sooner or later leads to riots.
Yeah, we see this over and over again. I was watching a special the other day that reminded me of something that I had forgotten a long time ago, which was the many riots that we used to have in Miami. And it was a very similar kind of scenario. It always starts with a population that feels just very unhappy for a number of reasons, and then the spark that sets off the powder keg is some sort of police incident based on the perception that this is just the last insult that the disenfranchised group can take. We see this over and over and over again, and I don't know if it's going to change anytime in the near future.
What annoys me is that people tend to use an incident as the fuse to set off the powder keg. I'm not a violent person.
I'm grateful for that, Simon.
Right. And, yeah, it always seems to boil down to socioeconomics. People are bored. They're looking for a reason to create havoc. And the havoc they create is not usually against the establishment, but they go and burn down local convenience stores, gas stations. I mean, they're ruining their own lives. Yeah, if you're going to have a good riot, you know, go burn something useful like the IRS office, or and I'm not suggesting that, but you know, they seem to cut their nose off to spite their face.
Well, I have one thought for you about that. A lot of them don't have cars, so where else can they go to riot? They go out their front door and they just wade in. And if they had enough cars that could drive to another place and do it meaningfully, they probably would. But that's one of the problems with all this. And John, you've spent a lot of time studying this in history. Do you want to weigh in on this subject?
Well, I'll give you my take, Manny. See, you guys can fire back at me. I believe it's kind of human nature, and myself included to some extent. We all kind of close our eyes to political shortcomings of the people with whom we disagree, and as long as they're politically principled, they can be personally unscrupulous, and you really don't seem to take much interest. It's like nothing needs reforming as much as someone else's bad habits. You know, we're a lot more tolerant of people with whom we agree. And there's a symbiotic relationship, and this has been going on for the last 50 years in the inner cities, between the Democratic Party and the poor. And poverty's become the vocation of millions of people, the destitute. They're mired in hopelessness, failed schools, gang-infested areas. And the general deal is long as they agree to remain poor and don't improve themselves and vote Democrat, they'll receive their entitlement check. And I saw it the years I worked down there, and it's sad. But I realized there's people down there, they never even leave the street in which they live for years. They'll live 10 miles from the beach and never go, never been at Disneyland. And I just realized over time, a lot of the people down there, they will never in their lives see anything beautiful. Unless it's on TV, like whatever they watch.
One they've looted from Best Buy.
Yeah, well, I don't think they're watching the Travel Channel, though. Anthony Bourdain, I love that show. I'll give a plug to him. But anyway,
so do I.
They never see anything beautiful. They never even, like, Manny's an Epicurean. He gets on me, but I can actually relate to this. They never taste anything savory or succulent. I mean, you know, taco. They don't go to a restaurant, Manny, where you look down at the menu.
Well, I could say neither of you with some.
Well, I'm personal now. And also, I'll end it with this, because Simon, I actually thought of you when I came up with this idea. They never engage in any intelligent conversation. And that's their lot, and they just continue in this state of depression. And it's like no one cares, and who's running the inner cities, and who's making millions. Welfare doesn't benefit the people who receive the check. I can tell you that. It benefits the people who are cutting the check.
Oh,
and that's what needs to be changed.
John, I could not agree with you more.
Well, thanks.
I worked in the arena of the homeless and working poor for 6 years.
Right.
And most people weren't looking for a handout, but they were looking for a hand up.
Most of them have accepted their lot. They are looking for a handout. They don't even know people with a job.
Oh, no, I
let me tell you real quick, Simon,
disagree.
What a lot, a lot of the girls, you don't hear about them, but I talked to many girls just killing time on a call, 13, 14. Their goal was to get an apartment either in their mother's housing development or down the street and have kids and raise a family by their mom. Nothing about finish high school, go to college, get married, have a career. I mean, how sad
okay.
is that? They don't,
okay,
they don't have any positive
role
model.
I'll concede that that is true.
You want to help these people.
The people that I was working with were people that genuinely were looking to better their lot in life.
Let me tell you one more quick story. I used to talk to this guy. He hung out at the liquor store 8 hours a day, the same corner, Vermont and El Segundo. And I said, why don't you go get some SSI? He hadn't done anything. So I took him down to, and mind you, he stays on the corner 8 hours a day. I took him down there one morning, and I saw him the next day. I said, did you sign up for the benefits? He said, no, the line was too long. I left.
Well, I got to tell you my favorite stream. Ash and I came out of, you know, the Twin Dragon on the edge of Beverly Hills, one of the best Chinese restaurants in the United States. At one point in the early 70s, Playboy voted it the top Chinese restaurant in the U.S. It's the one that started dumplings and everything that are now so common. And the owner, a longtime client and friend of mine, we had dinner one night on a Friday night. We walk out, and as you know, Simon, my wife's a big softie for absolutely everybody. And here was this homeless guy, and he said, oh, I need some money. She said, well, here, if you're hungry, take our food. And she offered him what I describe as about $40 worth of leftovers that she was dying to get up on Sunday morning or Saturday morning and eat leftovers. And he looked at her and says, oh, I can't eat that. I want money. And
man, his system would have rejected that food. It was too healthy.
Yeah, you know, that's probably true. But Ashley looked at him and said, he just wants money to go buy booze or something. And she just didn't. It just sickened her. It turned her off. And because so many of these people do have that kind of problem where they are looking for money for drugs or other things, and that is a problem in the community. But I don't agree with you, John, to a great extent. Your description could be the description of poor Italians and other people 50, 70 years ago, and the daughters raised to basically get married and do the same thing, would look for husbands and look for the same kind of lifestyle. You make it sound like it's, and whoever is poor, that's the direction they go. And that's
well, Manny, I can tell you, my grandfather came over from Italy when he was 14, never learned to read or write, signed his name with an X, and he ran his own business.
Well, but there are a great many Americans that are African-American and other descent have done the same thing. And my parents were both immigrants, and there wasn't a day in my life that they didn't tell me to go to school and be something.
Immigrants always have a stronger.
Well, wait a minute, John. Let me finish the story, because Sam's going to agree with me, and I'm going to go to Sam with this. I come from a split family. My father was Jewish and my mother was Catholic, and my father always said to me, "Never forget your Jewish heritage, because when you get older, people will deny you a job because of your Jewish heritage." And I used to go, oh, it can't be like that. And I'll tell you, I wasn't out in the workforce very long when I began to see anti-Semitism just as obvious as the sun rising every day. So a lot of families, a lot of minority families did that. I assume very shortly you're about to receive, Simon, a copy of Frank Capra's biography. And one of the things that Frank Capra points out is what the Italian experience was. And up until his death, I think he lived in 94, he still railed about the types of what I would call discrimination that he felt Italian-Americans were getting. He was sick of the Dago comments. He had a whole long list of them, and he was much more sensitive than, for example, his children are, who just don't really even see that kind of discrimination. And now Italians are such a deep part of the fabric of the United States, I'm sure listeners are going, Italians discriminated against? But yes, there was a time when they were. So whoever's the low end of the immigration totem pole is the one that's going to get this. And that's the way life is with every immigration. And the other last thought of that is, one of the problems the Jews had during immigration was, so many of them came from a conservative background. I'm sure that my grandparents wore dark clothes, and although they were not Hasidic, were very conservative Jews. And when my father went to Oxford and assimilated, I'm sure that they were not happy with him. And I know from family letters that I've read, they saw him as selling out the history of Judaism. And that's a problem in every religion. I hear it among my Chinese friends where the children are told sold out. Ashley right now has a tutor from MIT working on some classes, and he can't speak Japanese, so he's Japanese by birth, an MIT grad. And when he went home to Japan, everybody made fun of him because he couldn't speak Japanese. So I think that's the problem with immigrants. And Sam, did you make that same observation about Judaism and how we were raised?
It's funny. I was raised by two Jewish atheists.
My father was so much so, too. And I'll tell my one religious joke. I asked my father at some age why he wasn't a practicing Jew. And my father said to me, well, you know, I went to my bar mitzvah, I looked around, I collected all that money, and I knew it was time to get out while I was ahead. And that was my father's view about religion. So, and that
But I know about anti-Semitism. I still experience now. Here I am in the year 2012, right? We all are. Not just that. The country's has gotten more and more racist, more and more angry, more and more frustrated, more and more violent. I see it every day in my bar. Is it a phase we're going through? Or then, as my wife said, I think the Mayans are right. So let's just have a lot of fun for the next 6 months.
My mother-in-law from Youngstown used to say, oh, you know, let the Arabs have Israel. Well, what do we care? And I used to shake my head.
You Californiaites, I have a question for you. Where the riots have taken place in Anaheim and those areas, I don't know California that well. My sister lives in Calabasas, and my son lives up in North Hollywood. So that's where I've been. So I've been spoiled because I know what those areas are like. But where the riots took place, and I've seen the movie Boys in the Hood and things like that, as other people read stuff, how expensive it is for family to live there, to buy a home there, to rent a home?
Where, in what particular spot? You talking
about
like
South Central LA, I guess. South Central LA or in the Anaheim area, the riots?
South Central LA, you can buy homes for as low as $20,000, $25,000. One of the problems with South L.A., and it's true of the old areas, the brownstone area of Youngstown, is when they were built. So in cities like that, New York suffers from that. Of course, the older a neighborhood is the cheaper it is to buy or rent. And so these are always the lowest neighborhoods in terms of what rent runs. Also, I think you have to look at the fact that that's one of the reasons that we have urban flight. No one's willing to remodel those places because they're too small and expensive, so they move to another area of the city where they feel they can have a nicer lifestyle without spending any money. So these areas just keep declining, or the owner keeps them and rents them and is unwilling to do any repairs to them that would benefit the tenant. So these places just keep declining in terms of their quality. I don't know.
Okay.
Peter,
let's go to the youngster.
No.
Peter, what concerns me is that I'm seeing insularity appear. You know, rather than be the big mixing pot. You know, now we're going back to small little sort of groups that want to stick together, whether it be from Albania or wherever. I mean, this isn't what we're about. I mean, we're about being the mixing pot, you know, where everyone has a part to play. Am I wrong?
Well, no. Of course, you're not wrong in the sense that that's the sort of the theory and the patriotic ideal that serves as a backbone for America. But the limitation on mixing is always wealth. And, you know, people are drawn to members of their own community, but the real thing that breaks them out of that regionality, if you will, is the is their financial ability to do it. And when people don't really have financial means to get out of whatever community they're a part of, they tend to stay there. And I don't know to what extent we're more like that now or less like that now than we've ever been in the past. I kind of think that this is a human character trait and that it's the same all over the world. Certainly, I think it's the same all over the United States. It's interesting to me when we were talking earlier about what sets off riots, you know, and I was thinking about all the contexts in which we see riots. We not only see riots after the kind of events we're talking about, but I've also lived in downtown L.A., and I can tell you that when, you know, when there's a victory, when the Lakers win the title at Staples, there's a big riot at Staples, and which is in downtown L.A. And that may be a different kind of rioting, but it seems to me it's an expression of the same kind of dissatisfaction. There's also, you know, we also saw riots recently at Penn State after it was announced that Paterno was being fired. And that's a completely different group. That's a completely different group. That's a group of students, you know, rioting over their dissatisfaction with the university's decision. And, I don't know what changes any of this kind of behavior, if it can be changed. When people are very unhappy, anything can set them off. And I don't know what can be done to address that at all.
Okay, but would you agree that it may have its roots in socioeconomic situation?
I think it has its roots in economic barriers. I'm not sure. I must admit, I'm not sure what socioeconomic really means anymore. To me, the barriers seem economic. You know, when people will go wherever their means and their income and their hopes and dreams take them, I think. And if they feel, rightly or wrongly, that they're part of a certain pot and they can't get out of it, they tend to remain there. And if they feel that they want to get out of that circumstance, I think they try to do so. And the barrier that I always seem to see over and over again is economic.
Uh-oh, I hear crackling on the line. That must mean that John is opening his Snickers bar.
I thought someone was popping a bottle of wine.
Or somebody feeding a dog. I got the impression somebody was feeding a dog.
I thought it was John at Taco Bell as usual.
I think you guys have the I got to think it's the same way in the Simon Lives and the three on the left coast there. In Youngstown, there's been this big thing. We have in the projects or the Section 8 housing. Do they call it Section 8 in California? I don't know.
It's federal housing Section 8.
Okay, federal housing. They have a lot of the projects got huge amounts of money for stimulus to rebuild and whatnot and all that sort of stuff. But it wasn't just that. People started talking about that, how much it costs per unit and this and that, and that led to other things in the local media where it was basically coming down to that the person receiving Section 8 was usually a woman, black or white. They had 3-4 kids by 3 or 4 different men, but they were also, all the stuff with the furniture they were getting vouchers for, they had cell phones they were getting vouchers for or something, or were paying through that and something else. Appliances, utilities, someone pays for their gas, the water, the electric, and it goes on and on. And it's like, why would that person want to leave? What's the incentive for that person to get out of that environment and to join the working force when someone's picking up the tab for everything else?
That's a very good question. you know, why the hell would you want to get off your lazy ass and go do something if it's going to be handed to you on a plate?
Well, if you think that your only choice is getting a free lunch or working some type of minimal job to get a lunch that you pay for, if that's really the way you look at the world, then yes, you're going to take the free lunch. And I don't know what causes people to look at the world and say, the best I can ever do is working job A, B, or C, and as opposed to getting a free paycheck, I'll take the free paycheck.
Well, let's talk about that, Peter. I've spent a lot of time in South Los Angeles, and the general attitude is the anti-white attitude that the reason they can't is because essentially racial discrimination and a concerted effort throughout our country to hold them back and not to give them an equal opportunity to do anything. And they've got a lot of history to support that particular statement. And that's one of the problems. And I also want to come back to your comment about Simon raised the issue about ghettos. One of the reasons the ghettos exist is not only a commonality of culture because they don't want to abandon the culture from the country that they came to, but also language barriers. So a great many of these people come from foreign countries that don't speak English, that still speak the language of their lands. And the classic example is the Irish. Nobody really thinks that when the Irish came to the United States and immigrated during the potato famine, not one of them spoke English. So they had to learn to speak English to function in the United States. So those early generations of Irish immigrants couldn't even speak the language, but nobody stops to think of it because they think of Irish heritage as the Kennedy family and how articulate and well-educated they were. But they were not before, and Joe Kennedy and the rest of them had to learn the language and had to excel and do things that people now take for granted. And I think that's one of those things that gets frequently missed in all of this.
Well, okay.
And don't tell me, Simon, you had to learn a new language when you came to the United States just because you're British. It's okay.
Actually, what I was going to say was,
Simon had to unlearn a language to speak here.
Well, you know,
I had to unlearn how to spell words.
You know, that's true, too, Z's and S's. But, Simon, you do know that George Bernard Shaw once described the United States and England as two countries separated by a common language?
Yes, indeed. but my point is that if you want to make a new life in a new country, you should make an attempt to learn to speak the stinking language. And I don't see it.
Well, yes, and by the way, that's a family choice. And you see, you've heard a lot of complaints in Los Angeles about from Latino children who find out that their parents had illegally immigrated here, and it's subject to quite a controversy right now. And for many of those children, their parents basically wanted them to become Americans, so they didn't speak Spanish in their homes, and they did not teach them the Spanish language. So now many of them have been deported, and they can't speak in Mexico. They don't speak the language, so they're forced to go back to a country where nobody can understand them and they can't speak. And that's sort
all
of
right. Actually, my point was coming from a slightly different position. I spent some time in Canada, and Canada has two official languages. Which I won't get into the pros and cons of why they have French and English. However, they offer driving tests in all sorts of languages. And I go, why? You know, if you want to live in Canada, learn one of the two official languages. Why the hell should we translate, you know, everything into Azerbaijanian or whatever, you know, for two people?
Well, you know, you do know the history of French Quebec and its threats to withdraw from Canada. There was actually a period of time in which there was a revolutionary effort being fostered to break away from Canada, and they did this to try and quiet the unrest. So they basically caved in, so to speak, to political pressure, and that's not uncommon, because I think to a great extent that's been true in the United States too.
Actually, the problem with Quebec was that the rest of Canada didn't get to vote on that one.
Yes, absolutely. that could be said of so many things in the United States that we all feel we don't get to vote on, right, gentlemen? Isn't there a long list of things that bother all of you that you feel are done without a vote of the citizens? How about the way that Congress likes to reward itself? And even in California, I sent Simon an article that recently, while they were slashing teachers' pay here in the in California and all the rest of it, the legislature gave raises to their staff. Oh, that's really good. Did you know that, Peter? I don't know if you have slipped past you, but...
Well, I didn't know that, but it reminded me of a story. When I worked in Washington, D.C., as I indicated before, I worked for Claude Pepper, and he was from Miami. And when I was on the Hill back in the 80s, there was a big resolution that was passed. Apparently this happens all the time, and it was to increase, to give every member of Congress a salary raise. And at the time, Ralph Nader latched onto it, and there was a big public cry about how awful this was, that these guys were all getting raises. And it became such a political issue that basically every member of Congress started speaking out against it, with a few notable exceptions. But the way it was done is the system was basically jerry-rigged, in that it was already part of a legislative bill that had gone onto the desk of the president. At the time, it was Reagan. And the only way they could undo the raises was to have Reagan veto the bill. And, of course, Reagan didn't veto the bill. So, you know, by hook or by crook, these guys are going to get their raises, and they're going to give their staff raises no matter what anybody says or does about it. And they'll just find a politically expedient way to do it if the pressure gets too great.
Okay. Sam, I'm still hot under the collar over this whole language thing. I mean, how many languages do you translate your menu into at Bill's place?
Yeah. No, in the language?
Right.
He obviously hasn't been the youngest child, has he?
No.
Let's be honest about it. You translate this.
I can't even speak.
Translate this into Ohio State? Isn't that what you have to do?
do you offer a menu in German? You know, a menu in Chinese?
You want to know how they speak around here? Anything that everybody walks around remembering lines from The Godfather. Okay, that's what they do. If they can give a response, someone asks someone, they can give a response from a direct quote from The Godfather that made their day. Godfather 1, Godfather 2, Godfather 3. That's what dominates around here. It's gangster speak or whatnot or the things of that nature. But as far as a language barrier goes, I have a hard time. Just the way the language has been. No languages now, it's texting. That's what language is now.
Well, Sam, let me ask you a question. As a business owner, let me just ask you, let's just say you realized that there was a market that you could attract to your establishment, and this market would provide you with a lot of income and a lot of business. And you discovered that if you made attempts to cater to this market, that they would come to your establishment and they'd buy food and drinks and what have you. Pick any market you want, any demographic, Hispanic, Polish, I mean, whatever you want. I mean, would you consider revising or having an alternative menu or doing things that would attract that business sector to your establishment?
I'll give you a great example, and it's a great question you just did. Two years ago, we're not a sports bar. We'll never be known to be a sports bar. And on Monday nights, which is absolutely terrible, I was thinking about shutting the bar down. So I came up with the idea, you know, we have Monday Night Football. We could basically, I could have the best looking girls being naked behind the bar. No one was coming.
Wait, all I heard was naked. No. Did you say something about naked?
Yeah, naked. So
we got all of our
kids,
didn't he, Peter?
Yep. So what we decided to do is I went 2 years ago to 15-cent wings, jumbo, the best wings in the world with the best sauce. We always had. I went to 15-cent wings, okay? My business has boomed. My Monday night is the busiest night of my week. Better Friday and Saturday. We just turn people away, okay? But it's also attracted a huge African-American crowd, okay? And it's been a therefore, I had never realized, and I thought, again, being at the year 20, whatever it was, we did it 2010, we've got a black man as a president, we see African-American athletes, we honor them, Hollywood, Denzel Washington, you know, all those guys that, you know, racism is basically starting to, you know, go away. And I've been amazed at the whites who refuse to come to my bar now any other day of the week or whatnot, because the 15-cent wings brings in a quote-unquote poor element, which it does. I don't mean poor element of racial quality or whatnot. People don't have any money. I've had African-Americans come up to me and say, this is the only hot meal they eat during the week, okay, on 15-cent wings, okay? And it's scary, but I believe that it's true. And that's what we do, and we've attracted a people with less money in their pocket, white, blacks, green, purples, Chinese, and whatnot, and come up there, and they just, and we're never going to get rid of it. It's almost like it's my wife and I's soup kitchen, of a 2012 style with wings. But that has had an effect on my overall business, because a lot of people are mad at me because they think I'm catering to the African Americans and this relationship. If that answers your question.
Well, so you're going to maintain that practice of 15-cent wing nights, or are you going to discontinue it, or?
No, we're going to keep it because it quadruples our business. Yeah, for the most part, most people come in and they know it's going to be an hour and a half wait. You know, we're also going to get 15-cent wings, so they drink their beer, drink their liquor, they feed money into jukebox, they play pool, and whatnot, and that's it. It's increased my business. I guess the old term they use is the lost leader, and that's what it is. But
well, I guess my point is that, you know, in a rational economic world, if you realize there's a market or a sector that will help your business, you're going to make reasonable accommodations to attract that sector. And I suppose under certain circumstances, if somebody convinced you that having some sort of separate menu in a foreign language would help, you'd consider doing that. And even if you wouldn't consider doing that, there are other businesses and establishments that do consider doing that. The question that Simon's posing is, if I understand it correctly, Simon, is why should the government pay to have, different ballots and different initiatives printed in all these different types of languages? Shouldn't everybody be required to read and vote in English? Is that right, Simon?
Yep. You have hit it on the nail. I mean, you might not much care for my use of the English language. Yeah.
I do love it. I love it. I love it. Reminds me of Harry Potter.
Don't pander to him here just so much.
My point is that, you know, it costs money to, in print forms and all the rest of it. Why the hell should we cater to people that don't speak our language? If you want to live here, learn the stinking language.
Well, let me see if I can get at it a little bit. First of all, I'm not sure it really costs that much more money. Secondly, the comments you made me curious about how they handle the same issues in England, and you can talk about that. But thirdly, think about this, and just by extension, the business analogy. I mean, the people who eventually make the laws, eventually it comes down to elected politicians. And elected politicians have constituents, And if they can get constituents to vote, it benefits certain elected politicians. So at the end of the day, the decisions that are being made about changing ballots and things like that are being made by elected politicians, many of whom are elected by various constituents who may or may not have difficulty ascertaining the language. You know, that's probably what's really going on. The precise answer to your question, which may not be very helpful or illuminating, is in theory, if there is an American citizen out there who speaks a language, who for whatever reason is a first-generation immigrant and is a lawful American citizen and they just simply don't speak the language, why should they be excluded? That's probably the banner cry for why this is done. But I think at bottom, it's politics. It's politics being driven by the sense that certain constituencies will vote more if they can appeal to them.
Oh, okay. I'm going to...
And by the way, that's John's argument, right, John?
Right. I'm going to go to John because he's my new best friend.
We're like-minded.
Right. John, if people are going to live in the country, shouldn't they learn to speak the language?
Well, I'm just finishing reading this wrapper here. 2.07 ounces, 280 calories.
All right. Was the Snickers bar?
Okay. Absolutely, Simon. As I articulated earlier, if you don't speak the national or common language, it restricts upward mobility. Who benefits from that? The Democratic Party. If people assimilate, benefit themselves, start raising a family, paying taxes, they're going to vote Republican. So, of course, the Democrats want to keep the ballot in different languages, so these people aren't going to better themselves and remain ignorant and vote Democrat. And that's what's going on. The politicians are pushing this. Everybody knows if you want to improve someone's lot, like I said last week, for God's sake, get them an ID. And secondly, teach them English so they can start getting on with their lives and making some money like the rest of us. And like you said, Simon, the melting pot. This isn't a tapestry where every nationality needs to carve out a place on the blanket. This is a melting pot. We're all in this together. And I don't like separation. And all these ballots in different languages, it's not even the money. It just hurts the people who have to use it. And that's what annoys me. And we need some people. That's why I like the Tea Party so much, because they speak the common language, and I'm with them.
So you're admitting when someone earns enough money and their life is advantageous, they vote Republican, which is why the poor don't register as Republicans. And one of Romney's biggest problems, he's going to have to overcome the image with the poor, which was the subject of this show, that he can provide some type of equal governance for those people who don't believe.
Many of the poor voted for John Kerry, and John Kennedy has nothing to do with it.
Huh? Really? But they didn't vote for Richard Nixon. So what? Did Richard Nixon?
That's because he's a Republican. You're making my point. They don't care if somebody's rich or not. They just look D. They don't even know who they're voting for. I mean, they cancel out our votes. How does that make you feel?
Well, I just feel like you're making an elitist statement, that's all.
No, what do you mean elitist? I'm speaking from the streets, the people. I want to
see these
people improve.
You got that straight.
The streets, the people, the Tea Party.
That's right.
And by the way, this comes from a guy who committed the ultimate act of white flight and left the San Fernando Valley to live in Tony Westlake, the only African-Americans you ever see. The first question you ask is, what football team do you play for? Because that's the only African-Americans he's seen. And do you think that might have been influenced from years from working in Los Angeles and East L.A. in that area? Of course it was. John, you're just really proving my point in many respects.
Well, you haven't addressed my issues. You know the people who can't speak English all vote Democrat.
Well, my perception growing up in Southern California with the Hispanic population is that, you know, you may have one generation that has difficulty reading or speaking English or writing in English, but that's usually gone by the time their children are raised here. I mean, they're fluent.
Yeah, then they have a sense of entitlement.
Well, I don't know what they have. I can't speak for them, but they speak and read and write English fluently. They happen to be bilingual in my experience. They're fluently bilingual. They have mastered two languages perfectly.
And you know, having spent time with people like Cheech Marin, I guarantee you, Cheech Marin, who parodied the whole thing with his Born in East L.A., would make the same point: is that he's treated like some kind of idiot because his parents came from Mexico and therefore he doesn't speak the language and whatever. And here's a guy who's written books, went to Cal State Northridge, for those people who don't know. He used to perform when I was a young man on campus before his career got going, and yet he's still treated as if he's from some other world.
Manny, his father was LAPD.
I know that. I know that. Listen, I spent enough time talking to him. Anyway, make a long story short, the point is that what we have throughout the country is sort of a reinstituted form of racism. And what draws racism the most is a difference in money and a competition for work. Because the main objection to the Irish were they were looking for the same jobs that other Americans were when they came to the U.S., and that created a problem because there were competition. The problem with the African Americans, why there's more outright racism among the poor competing, they're competing for the same jobs. That's what the problem is, and that's where it always comes from, and that's where it'll come from in the future. The people who don't have money are competing among themselves for work. And racism just becomes another way to compete when you're applying for a job. Oh, he's from another race, and therefore you should be more comfortable with me. And therein lies the problem. But that also is part of the problem with the African American community is their belief that they are not going to be treated fairly. And because of that, they tend to accept more welfare, partly because they stupidly think it's owed to them, and partly because they become so, what I would call apathetic to the American system that they don't participate, as opposed to other cultures.
And Sam, are you an equal opportunity employer? Yeah, you've got the right segments of workers.
Sam, the government's listening.
That's okay. They've been listening to me for a long time. And
is anyone
hear what I have to say. They have been listening. As far as the English only thing goes, I don't know if it does save money, as Peter brought up. Did we really save that much money? Should we be doing that? Should it be an English only situation? I've really gone back and forth on that issue for years. It does bother me sometimes when I hear other people. The Orientals or whatnot, they'll be conversing and I can't understand them, what they're saying or whatnot, or talking. But that's my problem. They know English. I don't know Chinese or Japanese. So that's really the fault's really on me for not learning a foreign language. And
you can't say Orientals either, just so you know.
But I should say one thing. I had, when I was born in Boston and moved out here years ago, but living in Boston for 11 years, the Irish had all the police officers and just that, the other thing there. And what I learned is that they couldn't get, when they came over, they were easy to hire out as police officers and the women, the men, and then the women got jobs at working for wealthy people because English, or could understand English. So they assimilated that much faster in Massachusetts or in Boston, and I'm sure New York City too, that they could speak the language of the natives, or not the Native American Indians, the natives whites. So they had an advantage,
Sam, are you known as a Boston American?
Boston, maybe.
It depends on whether they're playing the Yankees or not, right?
But I don't think if you really think that's what's keeping back, the whole issue is just poverty. Don't all these people speak, if the issue is poverty, there's only one language that really matters, and that's the language of the dollar bill, isn't it?
And I think that encourages people to learn English. That's probably the greatest incentive of them all.
And by the way, I might argue that in some areas of South Los Angeles, Harlem, et cetera, they don't speak English anymore. They speak Ebonics and some truncated version of the English language.
Well,
then I agree with that.
There's some truth to that different dialects in different regions create whole new languages. So you could see that throughout the United States.
Like Mississippi and New Orleans and the Deep South?
Well, we could talk about, the evolution of the English language, but one of the things that's really, really fascinating about the English language, Simon, you'll be great anxious to know this, is that, our mother country created this language and then disseminated it all over the world, and the language changed. And it changed as a result of contact with different regions and different geographies and different climates. And it's one of the great mysteries that's still out there in the world. Why does language change? But anyway, language is language, and it changes all over the place. And you could have a completely different form of English spoken in suburbs of South Central Los Angeles, without a doubt.
And language doesn't change. Language evolves.
Okay. Good point. It evolves. Does my accent sound evolved to you, or does it sound harsh and grating on your ears?
I've been this side of the pond for more than 30 years, so actually the accent I really have a problem with is the British accent.
Well, they say that the most perfect form of the American language, if you put all the dialects together and you tried to get sort of a American English zero, in other words, the most basic pure form of the American English language, is actually spoken in Ohio. It's the place.
Not the Ohio I've been to.
It's the place that it's actually spoken in Ohio. It's considered one of the ground zero benchmarks in American English, in that it is the least influenced by regional accents. For some reason, as they get farther out from Ohio, they sense more and more regional sensitivity to dialects and accents. But, that's what they say. Take it or leave it.
Hey, Simon? Simon?
Yes.
I'd like to ask you a quick question, and then I'd like to make a statement, change the subject a little here, get you guys' opinion. Speaking of England, you guys have universal health care there, right?
They did the last time I looked, but I understand it was more than 30 years ago.
Well, here's my question, because I've heard people say we should model ours after theirs. I don't know about their health care, but I wanted to ask you real quickly, what's up with the dental plan there? Because a lot of English look like meth heads. They have the worst teeth I've ever seen of any nationality. Don't you guys have a dental plan in England?
I have no clue. It,
come on,
30,
Simon, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Look at those hooligans.
Well, there's a difference between a dental plan and an orthodontia plan.
But you know what?
Americans are obsessed with orthodontia. They're obsessed with great teeth.
Well, the English aren't bothered by it, right?
They're not bothered by it. That's less so than Americans, although I imagine that's changing.
You're really being kind. Simon, my father lived in the United States for 35 years. Came over here at the start of beginning World War II to speak for the British government to raise war bonds. Never left. And the day he died, he had the same British accent that he had when he moved here, and he was still proud of it. And to me, that summed up the Brits from his period of time. His best friend, who was pretty well known in Hollywood, would stop by every night on his way home, and they would have tea together. And when I was young, I used to describe him as two Brits at sea in America. And you're one of the few British people I know who truly have adapted to the American life. There's a resistance. They can be in India serving for 50 years as a what went on, in the previous century, and they still never dropped their accents.
Right. And personally, I'm all in favor of the Raj. I think it should be brought back.
Oh, God, we're definitely either curing or causing the world's ills. I'm not sure.
Hey, Simon, let me say something here real quick. I got a shout-out to the president. I don't get to do this very often, all right?
Oh, no.
He's been dying to do this. He just can't restrain himself.
Well, I
want to
get it in, and you guys can comment before we end. I wanted to give the president a shout-out because of his speech about who gets the credit for starting and running a business. You know, he said if you own a business, you didn't build it. The government provided the roads to facilitate commerce and flow to your business. Well, and I always like to relate things to a personal story of mine. I was looking back on it, and I thought, you know, having spent the better part of my youth chasing down crooks many times at high rates of speed in the streets of L.A., I always believed my success or failure rate of apprehension was determined by, like, the shape I was in, my driving skills, aptitude, heart, desire, maybe even a little courage, and as well as my assistance from, like, a competent dispatcher, coordination, containment of the deputies, era unit, maybe canine unit if they get a bite. But I now realize that actually the credit was all due to some faceless bureaucrat who requisitioned the road building and maintenance contract to a special interest group, lobbyist, or campaign contributor of the current administration. And I want to say thank you, Mr. President, for keeping me grounded.
Oh, Lord, I swear that you and I are going to go out to dinner, and I'll pay, but it's going to be ugly.
Simon, it'd be my pleasure. I deserve at least that much.
and you have to understand, Simon, do you remember the last time I paid for lunch, John? It's got to be a century ago, because John won't even let me pick up a lunch check.
No, I learned so much at Manny's knee that it's my pleasure. Simon,
Manny's
I feel the same way about you.
Manny's a cheap lunch date.
No, he's not. You haven't been to lunch with him.
All
the man's an Epicurean.
Is taken to Taco Bell or McDonald's.
Peter, now you know why you should avoid lunch with us.
Manny, I can't see you eating at Taco Bell or McDonald's.
No, I'd be in the hospital. You know, I have Crohn's disease and other health problems, and that's why I give them such a bad time about it when we eat out. And I send them every Taco Bell joke because, truthfully, I've written 4 books on this topic. Those are the things that are basically causing obesity and the other problems in America, as well as the illness, increase in illness that people are experiencing from cancer down the line. And John can sit there and make jokes about things that are going to one day kill him. But
man, you got to remember, I ate on the hood of my radio car for 15 years.
You just can't
take the ghetto out of someone and expect them to fit in at a place where they actually put silverware in a napkin.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the first time they did that, I said, what, do I have to use my fingers? And the guy said, no, it's in the napkin. So I didn't know.
Now you see why you can't take them anywhere.
but there is no doubt about it. John is not allowed out in public.
No, I wish
Nancy were here to comment, his girlfriend.
But Manny, I've actually been called Cooth since I've been hanging out with you.
You know, John, I've helped a lot of people in America, but you are not one of them.
So, Simon, you agreed with my comment? I'd like to get Sam's opinion, too, as a business owner.
I'd shoot to Sam. I'll reserve my comments.
Well, I tell you, I think the comment comes from something that that Elizabeth Warren, who was Barack Obama's teacher, I believe, at Harvard, started over the winter, which she said that she gave some speech when she was announcing a candidacy to take on Scott Brown. Oh, it was about, you know, the rich people didn't build the factories by themselves. They didn't make money by themselves. They did it out with other people's help. And she started that ball rolling, and she believes in that. And as Todd had, you know, self-proclaimed, what did she, 188th Cherokee, and was able to get all sorts of breaks from that and lying about her background being an American Indian or situation. But that aside, it's just amazing to me that that the president did say that. I don't think it was taken out of context. I know all his minions and all his people are jumping to that fact that, no, he really didn't say that. What he meant was...
But, it's in keeping with his philosophy.
Right, and that is his philosophy. I mean, I think the real philosophy, the more you speak, because he campaigns 24/7. I don't think he's, I've never seen a president. I thought Bush was bad. He was always out, you know, at his Texas ranch and doing all this stuff and campaigning with the photo ops. But I think Obama has got Bush beat with that. And he's not being the president. He's out running too much. And when you talk too much, you say the wrong thing because he's really spouting off his philosophy. But he came back and said,
"Did we lose Sam?"
I don't think we lost him. I think
that must have been the government getting involved right there.
No, taxpayers build every, you know, the money's taken from, you know, tax, whatever it was, tariffs or sales tax or, you know, whatever. It all comes from hardworking people, was it a rich or middle class or whatnot. And, you know, the money goes, and unfortunately, the money used to go to the right thing. Now it doesn't seem to be going to the right things. And I think for the president to say something like, "Hey, you didn't build that business, somebody else did," is a pretty stupid statement. I think that, there are men, your favorite, the robber barons, they were bad. I agree with you. But, you know, they did employ people. Did they rip them off? You bet they did. But that led to changes. There were changes, right? Eventually, you know, they had to have laws about, you know, unions were allowed, that you couldn't have child labor. You had to have some sort of rules and regulations came in place, and people realized that. And now the pendulum swung so far to the government being the do-all, know-all. I don't blame Obama for saying what he says because he believed that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and that's a sad thing because we are a free market society that can has to be one or the other. Because I think blending both of them has gotten to us where we are right now, has gotten Europe where it is right now. You've got to be one or the other.
Well,
okay.
I have a few observations. I agree with him in a tangential way. I don't agree with him specifically the way he said it. But, you know, there's two things everybody should consider. One is that when World War II broke out, we were able to respond simply because of all the efforts of FDR to try and balance this economy by artificially creating some type of, you know, conservation corps, all the other things, public works thing. And why did he do it? He did it to cut down and give people jobs. But in the end, his biggest contribution was the fact that we built all these roads, which became essential to the United States succeeding in World War II. One of Eisenhower's best things that he contributed, which he gets no credit for, is he insisted that we build the current highway system. Why? Because he realized the importance of moving troops across the United States in the event we were faced with another war similar to what we did in World War II. And so the government has done all this. Yes, everybody has been contributed, but the actual job of getting these roads built has been done by our government, who frankly did a much better job of it then than they do now. So if we have a weakness in here, it's the human frailty of how poor the people are that run our government, which seems to be a constant theme for all of us, the corruption in Congress, the self-aggrandizement, how they pay themselves before they do anything else, you know, the whole list of things. But a sound government has been the backbone of this country for a long, long time. And without it, we would not have many of the things that we have that are essential to this country. And I think that we need to remember that. And to that extent, I think that Obama is correct. But I don't
I can't resist. I'm going to put my John hat on.
Is that a toilet seat cover?
Something like that. Obama comes in, you know, the economy's in the toilet, and we get this bailout plan, shovel-ready projects. I mean, Well, what happened to that? Where are the jobs? I don't see them. And John, that means you owe me 2 lunches.
John, you'll be broke before this show is over.
Hey, if I could change one man's opinion, it's worth 2 lunches.
Yeah.
I mean, it was nary a couple months ago before Simon used to be a Fabian socialist.
Yeah. You know, I have to tell you that all of us are missing one very important part. The world has changed a lot since Obama's in office, and it's not been to the good. And I don't care who the president of the United States is, he would have to cope with the downturn in Europe, its effect on the markets, and a wide variety of other issues that people just didn't see happening before. So Obama, much like FDR, has faced so many more problems than any other president has, although I don't agree with the way he solved them or the lack of movement in some areas. But not one of you can convince me that this country would have been better off with, say, John McCain, for example. Oh, my God.
Oh, Sarah Palin.
I we still have good luck. No one would be moving forward, although actually I think McCain would have us in Syria, and probably we'd have more troops scattered all over the place and foreign policy-wise. But, I'm looking for an audio book. It's really scaring the you-know-what out of me. And it's by Neil Bolotsky. I think I'm pronouncing his last name correctly.
Right.
And it's called Bailout. And he was the inspector, a lifelong Democrat from the Southern District, New York, U.S. Department of Justice, a lawyer for the federal government. He was the first inspector in general for TARP. And he was nominated by Bush. He only dealt with Bush and Paulson for about 3 months, and then he was there for 3 years with Obama and Geithner. And it will scare you about how Congress gave the Treasury so much power to do whatever the hell they wanted to do with the money. And that's why there are no shovel projects ready, Simon, because the money is going to Wall Street, certain pet politicians, certain pet projects. And that's it. And this guy tried to stop a lot. And the guy is really scary. And I thought Paulson was bad news. It's just Tim Geithner.
Yeah.
And Obama gives him carte blanche and Bernanke to do whatever the heck they want to do. And that's why I think they would spend the whole Sunday on it.
Sam. When you talk about the Fed, the president of the United States doesn't control the Fed. That's one of the problems.
Oh, no, but he controls Treasury.
Well, yes, Geithner, I totally agree with. To me, appointing him was like appointing another fox to the hen house.
Oh, exactly. He does not. TARP was the inspector in general of the TARP was supposed to be able to have some sort of insight into the Fed. I mean, that was part of the way that it was written. But the Treasury, according to this gentleman who was the first inspector general, they were blocked all the way.
Manny, I hate to correct you. That was like appointing another Fox News to the hen house.
Careful, John might be upset about
I want to say I happened to see Neil Borofsky on a Neil Cavuto's show.
Yeah, he's John, you won't. This is what's freaking out the Republicans. When he's on, he's a registered Democrat, lifelong Democrat. He even gave money to Obama in 2008.
Yeah, I saw him. It was a good interview.
Here's what's great about him and his whole history. If you read it, he was the first one to break. He broke the Revco fiasco and some other things. That's why he got the job at TARP, because he did a great job as a assistant district attorney in New York.
So he doesn't embrace those Chicago values like Chick-fil-A.
Yeah, but he got the job because he's on.
Just knew.
Or was it?
Was it
Tammany Hall and Al Capone? I forget.
Right. But that's one that you bring up the And man, you talk about the government to build the roads, but they really didn't. there wasn't government workers out there. They hired people.
Well, yeah, it was contracted out.
Right, I mean, it's all contracted out.
And who paid for it? You did, running your business.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and so I don't think that, you know, and because they built the road, there's a business on that. There's plenty of empty buildings on the streets that my bar is on. Because there's a road there doesn't mean that it's going to be a successful
business. But you know what it is, Sam? He wants people to think if you didn't succeed, it's because of luck. The people who succeeded, they didn't work hard. It's luck. They were either born with money or they got some contract from the government, which people are very familiar with in this administration. So it really isn't hard work when you look at it like that.
This bar is in this town, I've told this before, that you
right.
see stimulus money. I didn't ask for any. I didn't get any. The majority of other people didn't. That helped them keep their doors open. I guess
so you could see how people succeeded. It wasn't their excellence. It was luck or government assistance.
That's correct. And or not just luck. How about just be running a good business? And my business has been around since 1971. We basically kept it the same way, same location. I haven't owned it since 1971. I've owned it since 1999. We succeed because I like to myself and my staff work together fabulously.
Mm-hmm.
We listen to each other. We talk to each other. We do everything together to make it put the best product
out
there.
Well, obviously, Sam, if you've survived that long, you're keeping an eye on the till. You're there.
Yeah, I mean, you have to be. And I have good. I have people work for me for 12 years and 15 years. We feel comfortable. And I think a lot of customers come up because they know it's not a merry-go-round of revolving door of employees. And that's important of any business. When you can see the same faces and whatnot, you feel comfortable. You go there, and not just the bar, and people feel comfortable that they can go there and then the bartender knows their name, so to speak, as they said, it's a great line. But I like going to certain businesses where I see the same. It's really comfortable to see the same people at the checkout line or the managing or at the Home Depot or whatnot. I always see the same manager or floor manager, very helpful what I need and whatnot. And I think that's part of their success, too. There has to be some synergy between ownership and workers. And I'm very proud to think that I have that. And other corporations, many other small businesses, what law firms or whatnot, have that too. And that's why it's successful, because the government did anything whatnot.
But you had to put in the hours.
You have to. I mean, I think every successful person does. I mean, I have to put my hours, write my book. I have to put my hours into running business. And I have to put my hours into enjoying my family and my friends and my and other things.
John, I mean, a silly question.
Yeah.
How many hours a day do you work?
Is that in front of the TV?
Simon, I use this to try to solicit business, so thanks for asking that. Probably 18 to 20.
I know the answer. I mean, you work every hour that you're awake.
That's very generous. Manny knows that's not true, but thanks.
No, it's not true.
Well, other than the time
but
you spend
I like to work. I don't have any hobbies, as you can see, and I like to work. So, yeah, if it's available, I'll work, absolutely. There's nothing else I'd rather do.
Right, and, you know, you're a quote, small business.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're not working the business, you're not making money.
Yeah, that's what, and Sam can attest to that. You got to keep your eye on what's going on, and there people don't realize like all the paperwork involved. And, you know, I'm a quick study, but still, like Manny and I have talked about this. When I retired from the department, I had the business experience of a 22-year-old kid, and it's easy to make mistakes, and you better pick things up quick, or you'll be out of business, because everybody has their hand out.
Right.
we're going to have to start ending this, Simon. We could go on for a week discussing it, but and these are the points that I'm raising. This is what separates people in America, those that are willing to put this separate out and those that aren't. The question is what to do with those that aren't willing to work it out, and whether or not ignoring them leads ultimately to situations that leads to riots, and whether or not we have to spend some money on the poor and disadvantaged to prevent ourselves from being in a constant state of revolution. So I think we're going to start with Peter and let Peter work around the table here and express any final thoughts about poverty, you know, what we've discussed, its effect on the general country, whether we can have possible riots in the coming years because of this, and all these other issues. And Peter, do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, all I can think of is if the cost of dealing with the riots gets so high, then they'll consider spending money to offset that cost or try to prevent it. But as long as the cost of the riots is less than the cost of trying to prevent them, you're going to see riots every now and then. It's just unavoidable.
Very good point. So, Sam, you have any thoughts on that?
Geez, that would be well said by Peter. I mean, no, I can't add to that or whatnot, but we do, we cover a lot of different things today.
Hey, it's a good, this is where we help our listeners. We offer them thoughts and views that they're not going to hear on any of them, and including John's beloved Fox, which only owns one opinion in the whole world, or whatever that is.
The only one that matters.
The only one that matters to you, anyway, but... So that is a difficult aspect of it. We cover a lot of different subjects, and along with those subjects comes a lot of different issues and problems. So, John, you want to weigh in on any of this?
I'll say something quick. I was going to compliment Simon, but we're on good terms now, so I'll forego that and give a personal story real quick. I'd like to address what's going on in Chicago. I have a simple solution. Throw the bums out. Replace all these politicians who are in there for careers. They're just enriching themselves at the expense of the people. And it's just hard to imagine unless you've been down there. I'll give people a quick story, which unless you work down there, you won't see it. Manny, I'm sure you have. But it was about 2 in the morning, and I was driving, and this black lady ran a red light right in front of me. You know, I normally wouldn't have stopped her, but it was like blatant. I had to slam on my brakes, so I pulled in behind her and I stopped her, and I just said, "What? You didn't see me?" And she said, "Deputy, you know this area. I don't stop at red lights." And I guarantee you, there's a lot of hit and runs going on in Chicago that you don't hear about now because people are even afraid to stop at red lights. So just think, if you lived in an environment like that, it's so alien to a lot of people who don't. But that's the way it is down there. And I would really like to see something be done about it. And the only thing we can do is get those professional politicians out of power.
I'm with you. And
you know, Simon, we can't let John get by with that comment. John, you're missing some really basic problems. We have a drug problem in our country. We have a drug enforcement problem. We have a situation like the roaring 20s when we had the Volstead Act and Prohibition, where there wasn't enough work. Our country was in a post-World War I recession. So guess what? The poor looked for professions and things to do, and guess what the one of them was? One of them was to sit down and to sell alcohol because it was illegal and profit by it. And as long as we let this illegal drug issue sit the way it is, and don't address it, we're going to have ongoing problems in this country because, much like liquor, we cannot abolish marijuana. We cannot abolish some other things, but specifically marijuana is the number one problem right now. And one of the things that would benefit our country was to tax these items and to get them productive in our society, because if you can't make it go away, you might just as well tax it, because we cannot afford to have this underground cash economy that's taking our money out of the country into other countries. I mean, I'm not saying anything you don't see on the evening news, and something that hasn't been talked about in our country forever and a day. So, you know, John, when you say get rid of the elected officials, no, get rid of the bad laws in our country. They're causing people to find the profession of drug dealing to be so inviting. If it weren't so profitable, they'd stop doing it.
Manny, how could you in good conscience remain in office for 20, 30, 40 years and see this continued misery? There's no conscience there. If it doesn't work in a few years, give up. Let somebody else try.
Well,
that was a spirited response, no pun intended.
Well, yeah, but John, you have to remember that that has not been the squeaky wheel issue, and that a significant number of people in politics support the legalization of marijuana. And I'm using marijuana because that's probably the only
I'm not talking about any specific issue, Manny. As you know, I support the legalization of marijuana. That's not the point.
I know you do.
I'm talking about
but
these
why?
People suffering, and no one does anything about it. Get them out. They're not going to do anything. It doesn't matter what laws we have. They're going to enrich themselves. Look at Bell, California.
Term limits.
Yep, I agree with term limits, too. And I also feel that we need to put some power in the people to be able to change the government of the United States when Congress won't. Because there's no way Congress is going to vote themselves out of some of these benefits that they're throwing in their pocket. And if it's not forced upon them, it's never going to happen. The same way we're never going to get a change in Citizens United because the politicians are just licking up the money and all the benefits they get from Citizens United. So why would they want to curb contributions that are basically polluting our nation right now? And that's one of the big issues. And that will be an ongoing theme for the show as we continue during this period of time, because guess what? Our politicians aren't going to do anything to make this go away. So we don't have much choice but to continue to discuss this until we can get enough Americans motivated to make the kind of changes that change our country. And despite what you say, I don't believe changing the President of the United States, although I'm not a big fan of Obama's right now, is going to ultimately change enough in this world to have a significant effect on this world. We need to change how Congress and the rest of them work and get them off of this, you know, what I consider the food line. I mean, people are dying to run for Congress, not because they want to serve our country, but because they want the lifetime benefits that go from being in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what
okay. We absolutely need to wrap this program up. But for those listeners that have stuck it this far, let me give you a quick Olympic update. Beach volleyball, which of course is a hugely popular Olympic sport, the men's team have just handed Japan their ass on a plate. Preliminary round, NBC managed to skillfully avoid, you know, showing any medals today, but they're really good at that. So that's it. Let's do it again next Sunday. What do you guys think?
Oh, we're not done.
Simon, if you
just
and I can
started.
Break bread, anything's possible.
I can't believe the Japanese lost.
The beach volleyball, no less.
Are you talking about this or the war?
How small is
the
one?
The Japanese lost to the Americans in volleyball? My goodness.
No, beach volleyball.
Is there any other kind of volleyball?
Well, yeah. I mean, the women. There's different types of volleyball.
There's the beach volleyball.
Peter, he doesn't understand where you live. Peter lives in the home of beach volleyball. There is no place like it, right, Peter?
No, there's a tournament this weekend. They call it the Six Man. It's down here right now. I'm sure a few Manhattan Beach residents were on the team that beat the Japanese today.
Oh, I'm sure they were. From Ibby May Trainer down the line, all of them are from your neck of the woods.
Yeah.
Okay, the Olympic motto is Citius Altius Fluvius, something like that. Highest, strongest, something or otherest.
I thought the Olympic motto was not in prime time, or is it a tape delay is really their motto?
Or don't get caughtest at the druggest testest.
Ladies and gentlemen, we'll talk to you next week.
Until then, goodbye.
Thank you.